I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The photographs and videos of Bucha, Ukraine, are horrifying. Dead bodies, some with their hands tied behind their backs, lying in the streets. A mass grave of bodies stuffed in garbage bags. Carcasses of military vehicles amid bombed-out neighborhoods. This is what was discovered after Russian troops left, a scene of unspeakable carnage. There's nothing new about pictures of war, but the images of this war in Ukraine gets us very close to the fighting and the toll it has taken on the civilian population. Our guest photojournalist Lindsay Adario was in Ukraine working for the New York Times. Her heartbreaking photograph of a mother, her two children, and a family friend lying dead on the street in Irpin trying to escape the violence came to exemplify the utter depravity of the war. She is an award-winning photojournalist who covers conflicts and human rights and joins us once again on Radio Times. Lindsay Adario, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Barbie Zelizer. She's a professor, director of the Center for Media at Risk, and that's at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. She's got a forthcoming book, How the Cold War Drives the News. And Barbie Zelizer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And Lindsay, let me begin with you. You have covered wars and conflicts all over the world. What is the job of a war photographer?
Oh, wow. I guess the job, my job and the job of all of my colleagues is to bring the horrors of the war and the reality of the war on the ground to the public, whether it's in the United States or elsewhere. I think, you know, we are the eyes and ears on the ground. We go to places that policymakers generally cannot go because of security reasons.
Well, and I mentioned that photograph, and this, you know, this was relatively early on in the war. I mean, it did go viral. I think a lot of people wouldn't know what I'm talking about when I describe it. And I looked at it again in preparation for the show, and it's obviously heartbreaking. We're seeing this family, you know, lying dead on the street, and their backpacks and suitcases and things that I think we can identify with. Do you think that's part of what made it so powerful?
I guess, and it, as you pointed out, it was early on in the war. It was at a point where Putin was saying repeatedly he was not targeting civilians, and it was very clear because I didn't just happen upon this family. I was actually there when the shell landed between myself and the family, and so I witnessed the sort of bracketing or the targeting of a civilian evacuation route from, you know, the original mortar that landed far away to a series of rounds that came in that got closer and closer to where people were fleeing. So it was clear to me what had happened. And, you know, for me as a mother, for me as a daughter and sister and wife, it's heartbreaking to come upon that scene of, you know, four civilians.
Well, to you, Barbie Zelizer, I'm kind of assuming that you know about the photograph that we're talking about. But when you look at the photographs of the war in Ukraine, are there certain things that strike you?
Yes. I mean, I think that the photographs of Ukraine are certainly following tropes that we have come to expect from other wars, right? Depictions of devastation and victims and survivors and witnesses. But I think that there are two things that we really need to be thinking about. And one is that the images aren't new, right? We certainly saw similar images in Chechnya and Syria and in Afghanistan before that. But there wasn't a mandate to see at that point, right? And there wasn't sufficient political action or responsiveness then. And the point here is that nothing about the Russian war apparatus is new, right? Another clear parallel that we're seeing is that the images that appeared after the liberation of the concentration camps in 1945. And I think that this is really important to understand how we are to respond to these images, because then, as is beginning to be the evidence now, right, we have clear moral and political mandates to show and see these images, as well as the technological capacity to do so. And so without that, right, we can't look at an image like the one that Lindsay Adario so brilliantly took and be able to understand the context in which it sits.
Well, picking up on that and going back to you, Lindsay, you have covered other wars and conflicts. Do you agree with Barbie that in certain ways there's nothing new about these images? This is what war looks like.
Well, I don't know. It's difficult to say because I covered Iraq, Afghanistan, Darfur, Congo. Yes, I've always witnessed civilians being the target, but this is pretty brazen. I mean, we are looking at the images coming out of Bucha are astonishing. I mean, people, civilians with their hands tied behind their backs, the road literally littered with bodies and mass graves. I saw mass graves in Iraq, but this is different. These are fresh graves. These are things, you know, for weeks, for about 4 weeks, we were trying to get to Bucha. I mean, as soon as the Russians entered there, you know, every day we would kind of drive toward Irpin and Bucha and be, you know, artillery would come toward us. So we could only wonder what was happening there. And now we're seeing. So I don't know. Maybe it's nothing new, but it's no less shocking.
Indeed. And Barbie, going back to you. When you see photographs, though, and you read, let's say, you know, we're reading about the war in Ukraine, and we also see the photographs. There's something about the photographs that tie us to the people that we're seeing in the photographs, and also there's something so emotional about them. Can you speak to that?
Yes, I think that when we get back to Lindsay's picture from Irpin, I think that what really is so powerful about that particular image is that it is kind of sashaying between what we're seeing, right, the particular details of that family and family friend, versus, you know, the universality, right, of the same photo, how that photo comes to emblematize the brutality of this particular war. And so when I say that the images aren't new, I'm not saying to clarify that right. The images aren't engaging us in a very powerful way. They are. However, we have seen images like this before, and I think that it's worth reminding ourselves why particular images kind of tick the responsiveness box, why particular images remain memorable.
Well, and picking up on that and going back to you, Lindsay, I mean, I think with images, one feels the need to act, right?
Yeah, I mean, the best images make someone feel the need to act. I think that not all images do. And for me as a photographer, I don't always know which images will inspire that reaction. You know, sometimes I take pictures and people, they react, but nothing like what happened on March 7th, where when that picture was published, there was an outrage, a worldwide outrage. And that is what we're hoping for, because people should be outraged. What is happening in Ukraine is outrageous, and it's astonishing that it's still happening.
I'm curious, as a photojournalist then, and you know, one has to be obviously respectful of the people that you're photographing, how you think about or maybe even struggle about how to frame a picture, whether to take a picture, obviously, of people in their most utterly vulnerable state.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very big part of my job, because I'm often seeing people in their most vulnerable or tragic moment. And I think, you know, in that instance, it was a rare occasion where I also had just narrowly escaped death. I mean, I was trying to figure out if I had shrapnel wounds on my neck because I felt the spray of gravel. And so I was a bit sort of also in shock when I was taking those images. And I remember coming upon the four bodies and taking a picture instinctively and saying, I can't believe what I just witnessed. You know, I watched it unfold, and then I kind of worked around the scene and took a few photos, almost because I knew, and I know because I've been doing this for 20 years, that we have to document this reality. We have to document these crimes. And it's not to say that I knew that the New York Times would publish them, but it's better to have those images and then to work with the help of a good editor or a team to help you decide what is respectful, what is okay.
Well, Barbie, I'm thinking of images of other wars that have, you know, stayed with us. You mentioned the, you know, the concentration camps, but also the images from the Vietnam War. Some of them, you know, I think will never leave us if we're paying attention.
Right. And I think they never should leave us. I think that these images are powerful because they are kind of, they're pulling together, right, very kind of unformed sentiments about what it is we actually need to do in response to these images. And I just kind of pulling from what Lindsay just said, I mean, the question of having witnesses, right, whether or not those are photojournalists who are on site trying to document, or whether or not those are images of witnesses themselves, right? Survivors who are looking at graves, or survivors who are looking at devastation. This is a kind of stand-in, right, for the public that really needs to be responding. And I think that, you know, it's terrific that people are paying attention now, and there is a response that is certainly,
We heard a doorbell. No, go ahead.
The doorbell, of course, goes off in the middle of this, that are certainly, going global. But the question that we have to be dealing with is whether this attention will be sustained.
Well, let me read an email from Patty, and Lindsay, I'll get your reaction. She says, my reaction was visceral horror to the savagery committed in Bucha, and at the same time, I feel frantic to be able to do something while knowing that I cannot. I can only hope that these images can serve as proof of war crimes and genocide. We're actually going to be talking about that in the second half of the show today. But as a photojournalist, do you feel like what you are photographing are war crimes?
I mean, it's a tough question because I'm not the expert. Obviously, there are people who can make that distinction. But yeah, I'm watching. If you ask if I'm watching the intentional targeting of civilians, obviously. I mean, I think we're seeing the images come out of Bucha. Civilians were slaughtered en masse. And so, yes, I think that we can safely say these are war crimes. But of course, I'm not the expert. I'm a journalist. I'm a photographer. I go into these situations and I document so that people with those tools can make those decisions.
Let me ask you, Barbie, about the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, his use of videos. He spoke yesterday to the UN. He spoke to Congress and other governments in Europe and obviously here in the United States. His use of videos to make his case for more action from the West. How do you see those?
I see that as a very important use of videos. I mean, I think that we tend to be a little bit uncomfortable when political leaders use videos of atrocities because we tend to feel that we're being propagandized. But the line between propaganda and clear persuasion and being able to use images to kind of drive points home that are otherwise unbelievable, I think that that's an admirable thing. And so I think that every time he does that, I think he is cementing the role of the image. But at the same time, I think we also need to recognize that the images that we keep that we are continually being shown, they are being taken out of context, right? We don't have a context in which to visually understand something like Lindsay Addario's photo, right? And I think that that is something we really need to be working on far better, especially if what we hope to do is use these photos for helping to sustain evidence of war crimes.
Well, I want to pick up on that and quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Barbie Zelizer, professor, director of the Center for Media at Risk at the Annenberg School for Communication. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us is award-winning journalist Lindsay Addario, who spent a number of weeks documenting the war in Ukraine. To join our conversation, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guests Lindsay Addario and Barbie Zelizer about the role, the power of graphic photographs and videos in documenting the war in Ukraine. And in about 10 minutes or so, we'll be talking about whether Putin and others can be held responsible for war crimes. Let me pick up on a comment from Joe. And Lindsay, I wanted to put this to you as well, in that you have documented other wars. You were recently back in Afghanistan. We know there's, you know, there's a crisis in Yemen. People are starving to death in Afghanistan. They're the Uyghurs. There's Ethiopia is now, you know, facing conflict. And we're not seeing those pictures. And Joe wants to comment. He says, I want to raise the issue of how different conflicts are covered. The civilian deaths in Iraq were in the hundreds of thousands, but it seemed like Ukraine is getting a lot more attention. I'd like to know what you say back to Joe. Go ahead, Lindsay.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. You know, the fact that the world has been motivated to respond, has been, you know, outraged by what's happening in Ukraine. It's interesting that same response didn't happen with the war in Syria or with Iraq as much. And I think, you know, I don't really have an answer to that. I think that the problem with the war in Syria, for example, was that it came on the tail end of a decade of war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And perhaps the public was just exhausted by, you know, these graphic images that are very hard to stomach. And so I think, you know, maybe with Ukraine, it's feeling different. It's in Europe, so a lot of people feel like it's in their backyard. You know, I can't really answer that. But of course, for me as a photographer who covers wars across the Middle East, Africa, you know, South Asia, I would hope that the world would respond to every war and every potential war crime and every human rights abuse equally, because they're all outrageous.
Do you want to add to that, Barbie Zelizer?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a proven dictum that we've always been willing to show and see some dead, but not others. And I think that it is a problem. I mean, it is a kind of very uncomfortable and egregious, in some senses, undercurrent to which wars we actually see. And, you know, there this comes from a whole set of conditions, right? You need a leader, right, a political leader who's able to strike the moral tone that makes people want or need to look, right? You need the technological capacity, right, to actually produce the images. And the point being is that underneath all of that, right, there are certainly unarticulated but nonetheless present preferences, hierarchies in the newsroom by which a news organization or news outlet will more readily cover one war than others. And so while I think it's terrific, the visibility that this particular war is getting, I think that we need to be using it proactively as a model for covering other wars in other parts of the world.
Here's another comment, this one from Jim. He says, I just want to point out how far we've come in war photojournalism. I think about how the Civil War was photographed and the bodies were posed to look like they were sleeping, and now we are okay showing the reality of war, what war really looks like. I'd be curious, Lindsay, what you think about that. And of course, there are people like you who are photojournalists, but then we've got, you know, everyone with their cell phone and the possibility of documenting what's happening, you know, in their world, in their reality.
Sure. And one comment I wanted to bring up was that, you know, a lot of this has to do with access. A lot of this has to do with, are we as photojournalists able to actually access the situation and do our jobs? You know, Ukraine is one of the first wars I've covered in many years where kidnapping isn't a huge fear. You know, it's very strange to be able to go to a place, if it's safe enough, if we're not getting shelled by Russians, to actually go and not worry about being kidnapped. I think, you know, we do have to worry about citizen journalists and anyone with the camera taking pictures, because we don't know if those pictures were posed or doctored, or, you know, we don't know the backstory. So it is very important in this time of social media that we actually get our news source from trusted sources. You know, that we know that journalists who are trained and working for the New York Times and the Washington Post and et cetera, they will provide you with images with the proper caption and factual information. And that's very important.
Well, and Barbie, you had mentioned context. I mean, that when we look at an image, you want to know, first of all, that it's real, but also to be able to put it into some kind of larger context.
Right, right. And I think that, you know, the question that we should really be asking is, why do we need an event of the magnitude of what we're seeing in Ukraine to make us pay attention, right? Why are some people still talking about whether or not we should even be seeing these images? And so I think that the question of context is huge. It's not only context as in what's going on around it, but history, structural factors, right? Complicating one-dimensional narratives, going deeper than segmenting the news event by event. And I just want to kind of add a shout out to Malachi Brown's analysis in these last few days of the satellite photos, a different kind of image making process. But they showed point by point how the images of dead civilians fit into the larger setting, right? And that analysis is really holding fast to the photo's ability to show things as they are, which of course is only part of what makes photos important, but which we are losing a little bit of in the images of dead civilians on their own, right? And I think that the overwhelmingly responsive feedback that those analysis is getting suggests that that kind of context is more of what we need.
Lindsay, sounds like you wanted to say something.
Well, I think it's particularly important during this war, as in, I guess, a lot of wars, where we have Putin basically saying everything is fake news and these are doctored photos and they're not real, because this is in direct response. You know, there are satellite images, there are journalists on the ground. These are, in fact, real. So, you know, it's important to say that we're up against a president who is basically falsifying reality. And this is the proof that this really happened.
Barbie, do you worry about the kind of exhaustion of the images that come from war?
I do and I don't. I mean, I worry that the same images get shown repeatedly across news outlets. I think that is a worrisome trend that we've had for as long as we've had photographs. But I think that the insistence on seeing photos should by now be part of our visual environment, right? We see images of brutality in fiction, on movies, in the internet, on television, right? Why do we allow ourselves to be able to see what are really kind of repetitive visual themes all the time in our fictitious environment, but we come kind of, you know, we become very protective, right, when we have to see them or when we are asked to see them in our fact-based environment. So as far as I go, as far as I see it, I think that we can't get enough of these images, and I think that we need far more attention to what the images show us that is different from what the words tell us.
Do you agree with that, Lindsay Addario?
I mean, of course I do. I wouldn't do my job if I didn't. I also think, you know, if a publication chooses not to publish an image at this point, it will appear on social media. So it's not like, you know, I think the idea of making a selection of images palatable for morning breakfast and for the reader to look at, it's a different reality. People are getting their news sources. People are looking at their screens all the time. They're seeing these images, whether they're published in mainstream media or not. These images are out there.
Well, and what I noticed, too, at least on television, which is the viewers are given a warning. And Barbie, does that seem fair?
Yes,
the warning basically saying this: what you're going to see is disturbing and graphic.
Yes, I think that's very fair. I think that it's on the news organization, a news outlet, to actually caution people about what they're going to see, especially when there is such kind of widespread discomfort, squeamishness about seeing graphic images. So I think that the warning is fine, but I think that I hope that the news outlets are going to continue showing images with those warnings.
And Lindsay, do you have plans to go back to Ukraine?
Yeah, I may go back next week, actually. Wow. I'm just trying to work it out now. Yeah.
Well, your work is just extraordinary, and we're so grateful to you and the other photojournalists in this war and, frankly, other wars and conflicts around the world and helping us understand what war looks like. So thank you once again for joining us on Radio Times.
Of course. And thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And that's award-winning photojournalist Lindsay Addario. And Barbie Zelizer, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good being here.
Nice to have you with us. And again, Professor, Director of the Center for Media at Risk at the Annenberg School for Communication, and that's at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky did not mince words yesterday addressing the UN Security Council after touring Bucha, a scene of unspeakable carnage. He accused Russian troops of deliberately targeting civilians, quote, just for pleasure. He criticized the council for not intervening to stop the war in his country and called for a Nuremberg-style tribunal. He said it was time to bring the perpetrators to justice. Well, Zelensky is not alone. President Biden called Putin a war criminal. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said what we've seen in Bucha is not a random act of a rogue unit. The reports are more than credible. The evidence is there for the world to see. That's a quote. So what constitutes a war crime? How do prosecutors build a case? And how do they hold leaders accountable? Our guest is David Crane. He prosecuted former Liberian President Charles Taylor, who was sentenced to 50 years in prison for war crimes and crimes against humanity. That's when he was a founding chief prosecutor for the UN Special Court for Sierra Leone. He is currently a distinguished scholar in residence at Syracuse University College of Law and the founder of the Global Accountability Network. David Crane, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. We've been talking about photographs on the radio, but nonetheless, we have all seen them from Ukraine. We've read reports from Ukraine. Everything that you've read, are we witnessing, are we seeing war crimes?
Clearly, we're watching, we're seeing war crimes, of course, from a just an actual and political point of view. You know, obviously, over time, legally, we'll go into court and prove those. But clearly, these are war crimes. And, you know, President Biden was very, very correct in calling out a rogue head of state who no longer has any credibility that he is a war criminal. It was a political statement, but a correct political statement. We need to isolate and focus on his crimes. And he bears no legitimacy anymore as far as a sitting head of state. And this will continue to dissolve around him as time goes on. Well, it happened with Charles Taylor when I indicted him and investigated him, and it'll happen with him.
And it will happen with him. I do want to get to that, but I want to make sure our listeners understand when you say we're seeing war crimes. So obviously the targeting of civilians, is that considered a war crime?
Yes, it is. You know, the concept of war crimes comes from a series of conventions, protocols, and treaties that is called the Laws of Armed Conflict. And one of the cornerstone principles of that Laws of Armed Conflict is that a party to a conflict can never intentionally target civilians. And that's what the Russian Federation forces are doing, and that's clearly a war crime.
And we're talking about targeting civilians, targeting hospitals. There was a theater in Mariupol. Apparently, there were big words on the street that said, you know, essentially there are children in here. That was bombed.
Yeah, you know, you can only target militarily necessary objects. If there's no militarily necessary reason to target that object or persons, then again, it is a war crime. So targeting protected places like where civilians are and clearly mark where they are, or hospitals, or places that civilians tend to be without any kind of military necessary reason to do so, again, is a violation of the laws of armed conflict and a war crime.
And the displacement, you know, we've got millions of refugees. Is that considered a war crime?
Yes, causing civilians to move about is enforcing that and then targeting them is also a war crime. But also we have to understand that we have two other international crimes going on here. We have the crime of aggression, and we also have crimes against humanity, which is a widespread or systematic attack on civilians. And this clearly is what's going on here as well. So if I were a prosecutor and I just published his indictment this morning, a sample copy of, I would charge him both for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
And him being Vladimir Putin. And going back to Charles Taylor, I know it took something, what was it, like 10 years to to prosecute and then find him guilty of crimes against humanity and war crimes? Is that how long it takes?
Well, again, each and every case is different from the other. However, we do have the experience, the rules of procedure, and the substantive law to prosecute heads of state. I was the first one to do that, and Putin would be the second one in the modern era. The bright red thread of international criminal law is politics. The creation of justice mechanisms like a tribunal or court, are based on political acts and political compromise. And so DNA is in the it's in the DNA of these justice mechanisms. That doesn't mean it's a negative, but it'll be a political decision to hand over appropriate defendants, to include a head of state like President Charles Taylor. Took the international community 2 years to hand him over to us, but we did, and he was prosecuted openly and fairly. Now, the trial itself took a couple of years because of some legal wrangling, and he fired his defense counsel and stuff like that. But, Charles Taylor, like Putin, never thought he'd be held accountable for his war crimes and crimes against humanity. And as you very correctly said in the introduction, now he's sitting in Her Majesty's maximum security prison somewhere in the United Kingdom for the rest of his life. And so, justice does move forward, and someday there will be a political condition by which Vladimir Putin will be handed over to the ICC and over potentially a special court for Ukraine as well.
Well, President Zelensky, and I'm going to misquote him, but essentially said, look, the world is watching. And if Putin isn't held accountable, there are other like-minded dictators who are going to take a lesson from the world community if he isn't held accountable. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. If we don't do anything now, if we give Putin a pass, they're sitting around like crocodiles. Just watching what happens. If we step away or do a half measure related to the war criminal Vladimir Putin, then it's going to be a very dangerous world. I can see Kim Jong-un or the president of China, all of a sudden Taiwan's attacked or North Korea attacks South Korea because they realize that they're impecunious. So we have to step up. The world's democracies, all the world, and face down Vladimir Putin, or it's going to be a very dangerous world.
Almost up on a break here, but Douglas asks, saying satellites can take incredibly detailed pictures. Are those being saved to be used in prosecuting war crimes?
Yes. It's interesting. When I was prosecuting in West Africa, we didn't have all of this technology, and so we had to do it the old-fashioned way. But now, over the past 20 years, technology has changed, social media has changed. We have petabytes of data, which is out there. Your listeners have to understand, the rules of evidence still apply in a tribunal or court. So 99% of all of this data out there, to include satellite images and stuff, is useless in court unless we can authenticate it and prove its relevancy. And that's kind of something it's almost like to find appropriate evidence, we have to look for that piece of evidence in that haystack.
Well, and I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's David Crane. We're talking about war crimes in Ukraine. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscow, and we began our show today talking about the power of graphic photographs and videos in documenting the war in Ukraine. And now we're talking about how to hold Putin accountable for war crimes. And our guest is David Crane. He's founding chief prosecutor for UN Special Courts for Sierra Leone, which tried and convicted former Liberian President Charles Taylor. He's currently a distinguished scholar in residence at Syracuse University College of Law and the founder of the Global Accountability Network. And we have lots of people that want to join the conversation, you can as well. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. David, you were talking about evidence. Obviously, in a court of law, you need evidence. My understanding is that there are people in Ukraine who are already talking to people, trying to get testimony about what might have happened in their neighborhood or what might have happened to their family. Is that how you build evidence in a case involving war crimes?
Well, you know, in an atrocity zone situation and one as large as the Ukraine, we have a lot of right-thinking people doing important things and less important things. In some ways, they're stepping all over the evidence or getting in each other's way. Mm. So that's why it's very, very important that we get professional investigators in who are experienced in war crimes investigations to get control of the situation. NGOs are over there doing what they think is best, gathering data. But at the end of the day, you know, this is a court of law. These aren't kangaroo courts. And if I was prosecutor for the Ukraine, I would have to go in and follow the rules of procedure and evidence to prove my case beyond a reasonable doubt. So at this point in time, things are a bit chaotic, but as we move forward, the professional investigators will be coming in and getting control as Russian forces are moving out and we begin to catalog these terrible acts.
Who are these professional investigators? Do they work for the International Criminal Court? Who are they?
Well, yes. The International Criminal Court has opened a preliminary investigation. We do have a mission of inquiry from the UN Human Rights Council. We also have the Ukrainian Prosecutor General, who's also doing these kind of things. And eventually we'll be having a, probably through the UN General Assembly, a hybrid international tribunal with the concurrence of the Ukrainian government to prosecute aggression. So, you know, this is happening and will happen. But again, it's just really important for your listeners to understand, even though we have all kinds of video and all kinds of testimony, that still has to be collated in proving each and every element of these international crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. It's very much like prosecuting something in Philadelphia. You know, these things have these procedures. So sometimes you can be overwhelmed by data. But none of this is evidence. This is just data that has to be converted into legally sustainable evidence.
It can be done. I'm glad you added that. But when it comes to the International Criminal Court, Russia is not a signatory. Ukraine is not a signatory. The United States is not a signatory. Does that raise issues or questions for you?
Well, it's important for you, again, just to understand that Ukraine has submitted its jurisdiction on these war crimes and crimes against humanity. So I don't want to get too technical, but the bottom line for your listeners is the International Criminal Court does have jurisdiction over the war crimes and crimes against humanity of crimes being held in the Ukraine. And Ukraine essentially has given the ICC permission to investigate and to prosecute. Now, the crime of aggression, there is no jurisdiction by the ICC. So the UN will have to set up a special court for Ukraine to prosecute that act. But, you know, these two tribunals can work concurrently to seek justice for Ukraine.
Here's some comments. One from Rick. He says, I think when our leaders condemn what Russia is doing, which is horrible, we also have to acknowledge that the U.S. has done terrible things, too. In Vietnam, Japan during World War II, I guess that's talking about the bombing there. He also added that Bush and Cheney were accused of war crimes. How do we factor that in?
Well, you know, it's as again, it is seeking justice for victims of atrocity it does have politics in it,
sure.
And I'm not going to be an apologist for any of the acts. All peoples, all cultures, all countries have the capacity to commit atrocities, and the United States has done that, and we have to acknowledge that and try to avoid it. But that doesn't give us an excuse not to do something now, and so that's why we have to continue to do this. But yeah, I certainly concur with the comment that was made.
Paul says the New York Times has a drone video today of a person. I actually watched this morning, a person on a bicycle being shot from an armored vehicle. You can't make out if the cyclist is a civilian or assistance or a soldier. Is it legal for armies to kill civilians who are engaged in acts of military resistance?
You know, that's a very good question, and I appreciate bringing that up. Anybody who takes up arms against a combatant in a conflict does legitimately become a military target. The right of self-defense is an appropriate response. So if a civilian takes up an AK-47 and starts shooting at the tank can return fire because that civilian loses that protected status.
How do you decide? I mean, we're hearing these horrific examples of torture and rape and you know, summary executions. When you look at the chain of command, you've got the soldiers, you've got their commanders, and then, of course, you've got Vladimir Putin at the top. How do you get to Putin?
Well, again, we call this the concept of command responsibility. By law, the president of the Russian Federation is also head of the military. So he commands the military, and so he's individually criminally responsible for each and every war crime or crime against humanity his armed forces are committing in the Ukraine. That's what I'd use to prosecute President Charles Taylor as well. You know, it's just interesting to note that, you know, the President of the United States is Commander-in-Chief right. of the Armed Forces of the United States. So it's the same kind of thing. By virtue of the fact that he's president, he commands those forces. So he is individually responsible for those war crimes and will be prosecuted based on that, on the principle of command responsibility, as will his commanders, who are also equally liable.
Do you worry, though, that President Biden said, you know, Putin is a war criminal, should be held accountable. Others have said the same things, that those become empty words, you know, if something isn't literally done?
Well, of course they're going to become empty words if nothing is done, but I don't think that's going to happen, and okay. I truly believe this. I've been doing this for a long time. I have not seen the world more focused on doing something about something related to an atrocity than this time. You have to understand, we had 141 nations condemn the invasion from the UN. That's over 75% of the United Nations General Assembly condemning this and calling out the Russian Federation for human rights violations. So the political moment is here to create these courts and mechanisms. And of course, we do have the world's permanent international criminal court that has started a preliminary investigation. And so we can be assured that that prosecutor will do something as well. So I really do believe, and take this as a very considered judgment, mm-hmm. Something will happen. So these won't be empty words.
Is that because we're looking at a war in Europe? And I mean, we saw, you know, Bosnia not so long ago. But what we're seeing in Europe is a war rather like World War II.
Well, it is an international armed conflict, not unlike what we've seen in Europe since World War II, and that is the case. But you know, we do have to understand. And again, I'm an apologist for the system. You know, the world politically over the past several years has looked away from Syria,
right.
Myanmar, the Uyghurs in China, Yemen, Venezuela. But now, because of this international armed conflict in Ukraine, you just can't look away. But let's not forget that we've had atrocity crimes going on for years with the world looking the other way, particularly with the lack of leadership by the United Nations.
Mm. Do you see the United Nations more empowered? I mean, I should say yesterday Zelensky was essentially shaming them for their inaction and giving Russia the kind of veto power that it has.
Well, the United Nations has not covered itself in glory over the past several years. It's been largely irrelevant, particularly due to the fact that the UN Security Council, which is the operative arm of the United Nations, has been deadlocked, just like the Cold War, where Russia and China refusing to do anything related to any atrocity crimes. And, you know, Russia and China, you know, are the world's greatest perpetrators of international crimes. So nothing can be done in the Security Council. So that's why you have the General Assembly stepping in, which they can do under the Charter to, under extraordinary circumstances, basically sidestep the the Security Council. And that's what's going to have to happen from now on, because Russia and China are permanent members with veto power. Right. So, yeah, President Zelensky was exactly right. Calling out, saying something has to be done. If not, then we have a dual criminal system where the three major powers are impecunious, while the rest of the world has to has to follow the law. So it's an important point that Zelensky made yesterday.
You believe that Putin will be held accountable. Michael says this discussion is pointless because Putin is never going to be tried for war crimes. He will never surrender. His people will never give him up. It is never going to happen. David Crane, I want to give you a chance to respond to Michael.
Well, Michael, again, I appreciate that. And the answer may be just what you're implying. Yeah. But never say never in this business. Like I said, Charles Taylor never thought he'd be held accountable for his war crimes and crimes against humanity as a head of state, and yet he is now sitting in a prison for the rest of his life. There's no statute of limitations in international crimes. So he has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity. Once the appropriate jurisdiction indicts him, he'll be a war criminal for the rest of his life. So it may not be 10 years from now, but eventually Putin will be handed over. There just has to be a political circumstances to do so.
And when you say handed over, you literally mean handed over, right? That someone at some point in Russia will hand him over to some kind of tribunal.
Well, that's the theory. It happened with Charles Taylor.
Yep.
Nigeria handed it over to Liberia, who promptly handed it over to the UN Special Court for Sierra Leone, where he was given a full, an open and fair trial. So, again, yes, I can see a real doubt by your listeners, and fair point. It's not a matter of time. It's a matter of appropriateness.
Here's a tweet from Samuel. Says, can you talk more about the transition from the total war of World War II to the new rules of war post-war era, such as not targeting civilians and the defining of war crimes? And of course, I guess as part of that is Nuremberg, but obviously the horror of the Nazi Holocaust.
Well, the world developed in the middle of the bloody 20th century a set of 4 years where they created the cornerstone by which we now hold heads of state accountable and also hold up the principles of intentionally targeting civilians. You have the UN Charter, you have the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg and its principles. You have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and as importantly, you have the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which does state that civilians are especially to be protected in conflict, and you cannot intentionally target civilians in a conflict. And of course, as we've been talking, Russia is clearly doing that.
Would the atomic bombing of Japan, would that be a war crime today then?
Well, it's interesting. Right now, we do have the International Court of Justice has said that it is not. As awkward as that seems
really?
To your listeners,
wow.
but the bottom line is probably not. Should it be? I think so, personally. Yeah. But again, we have this anomaly of these nuclear weapons that's sitting out there. And of course, Putin is sitting next to the big red button, and this is a terrible kind of counterweight to what we are doing.
Zelensky said that what happened in Bucha, Ukraine, and hopefully we have all seen videos and pictures from what happened when Russian forces left. He called it genocide. Is that what genocide looks like? How do we understand what that is in the context of a war crime?
Well, genocide is one of the four international crimes: war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and aggression. Genocide is a specific intent crime, and I don't want to go too far down the legal road, but Putin has to specifically intend to destroy in whole or in part the Ukrainian people. In other words, salt the earth. In other words, do away with all of them or start to do that. I don't see any evidence of that, but I do see clearly war crimes and crimes against humanity. But at the end of the day, this isn't a panoply of war crimes. There's no ranking. There's no tier system. The deaths of the people in Bucha is a crime against humanity and a war crime. It doesn't matter whether it's a genocide. Politicians tend to throw around the word genocide, but it is a legally specific crime. It's very difficult to prove. You have to almost have a smoking gun that shows that Putin directed his commanders to kill all of the Ukrainians.
We're almost out of time here. You mentioned that Charles Taylor is in a British prison 50 years. Have you ever visited him there?
Why would I?
I don't know. I was just curious.
No, not at all. I have no reason to do that. He's individually criminally responsible for the aiding and abetting of the destruction of over 1.2 million human beings. He is in the right place, and he gets up every morning knowing that the people of Sierra Leone know that he is incarcerated. And, again, the people of Sierra Leone, the victims, know that they won and not him.
Well, David Crane, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, and I really appreciate these very, very important questions.
Indeed. And he is Distinguished Scholar in Residence at Syracuse University College of Law and the founder of the Global Accountability Network. And the network just wrote a paper essentially accusing Vladimir Putin of war crimes in Ukraine. Go to WHYY.org. You can look for Radio Times under programs to find out more about the show and to listen to lots of different programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you for joining us.